We'll use side dress nitrogen, split N as an example. The wider angled roots are more responsive to split applied nitrogen. And that makes sense because they're in the surface area. Those umbrella roots are wide. They're in the surface profile. So that side dress N goes right to where the roots are. We find narrow roots that drive deep do really well in stressed environments because they're either chasing the nitrogen down, or if it's water stress, they're looking for that. And so now we start piecing the story together. What type of root is best for your system? And this is where maybe in a no-till high-yield environment where we have nutrients in the surface, do we need to be selecting wide-rooted hybrids to find the nutrients in the surface soils? Whereas if we're in fuller, more tilled systems, a more general root that has a good surface area and explores the soil is the better pick.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Mark Licht, Associate Professor and Extension Cropping Systems Specialist at Iowa State University. Please subscribe to the channel to receive notifications of new episodes. Today, I welcome to the show Connor Sybil, Research Assistant Professor from the University of Illinois. Good morning, Connor. How are things going? Hopefully well, as we're recording kind of right on the tail end of harvest.
Yeah, things are going really well. It's been dry, so harvest is almost done. So we'll get to enjoy some days in October. We usually don't get free. So
let's start this episode with maybe you just explaining your path as you went through undergraduate and through your graduate degrees to where you're at now as a research assistant professor.
Yeah, well, this is where I can let out my dirty little secret. I am a true Illini inbred. So I was born and raised in Northern Illinois, a small town, had some sheep for 4-H and FFA projects. That's where I got involved in agriculture, helped do a lot of summers baling hay for the neighbors, and thought, wow, this is something I really enjoy, what I want to pursue for school. So I came down to University of Illinois in fall of 2013 for my undergrad in crop sciences, did what most undergrads are recommended to do, found some internships, did one in sales, one in seed production, and then that last one was in small plot research with BASF just outside of campus here. And I really liked that. I said, this is cool, the small plot, the research, product development. How do you do that for a career? And it was strongly recommended, if you want to be in research, whether academic or industry, graduate school is probably your next step. And through that, my boss was a former student of Dr. Fred Belo. So we made the connection there. Corn, soybean, high yield production, small plot, same thing I had learned on the internship. And it was a good fit. And so I did my master's and PhD here on campus with Dr. Belo. And I was through and through going to be an industry product development research scientist till the very last year of my grad work. And I really enjoyed being able to work with farmers and that independence that we get with the university, the extension, and a lot of our ability to choose what we want to work on. And then went down into the academic pathway, did a 2-year postdoc, and just last fall, so I'm 13 months on the job as a research assistant professor now at Illinois. Doing corn, soybean production with some extension responsibilities as well.
Very good. It's always interesting to hear these kind of career paths, right? And not that I have the exact same path, but I have 4 degrees from Iowa State University. So I definitely have, you know, some of that pedigree, you know, all from the same institution, working with different faculty as well. So very good. Now you're focused on kind of residue management and some work with corn root systems and that architecture. So I think we're going to maybe jump into that a little bit. Here are some of the things that you're working on and some of the things that you're finding. So let's start off, you know, right away with maybe a broad question. You know, what residue management strategies are you finding to be most effective for ensuring success in these high residue corn systems that I think we're just going to always have now that we're getting into higher yield levels?
Yeah, and the focus on residue started a little bit in my grad work. I had a pretty strong focus project on continuous corn and minimizing the continuous corn yield penalty, which is often associated with too much residue going out year after year and trying to manage it. But as I progressed into my current position, you start going to these conferences or talking to agronomists and extension specialists, and that word residue seems to be coming up more and more frequently. There's some obvious cases for that, right? No-till is, you know, visually you can see the more residue out in the fields. Cover crops are making a comeback. So that's more residue that we're having to deal with. And then especially in Illinois and I think Southern Indiana, wheat and double crop systems are making a comeback. So now two crops in a year. So residue continues to climb, but then back to your question, as you phrased it, you referred to high yield corn. And I think that's important reminder to kind of start the discussion because I'm in East Central Illinois where there's a lot of conventional fall plus spring tillage, not much cover crop. We're too far north for the double crop. And a lot of folks say, why should I have that residue conversation? And the simple reply is, have your yields gone up in the last 5, 10, 15 years? And almost always the answer is yes. So you have more residue.
That's just the nature of the beast with corn, right? Higher yields, you're producing more plant material to support those high yields, right?
Exactly. And we did the math, assuming your average harvest index, about 52%, give or take. Every bushel of corn you produce sends 44 pounds of dry matter out the back end of the combine. And some people go, well, that's like a straw bale. Is that really that much? And I say, well, have your yields gone up 10 bushels? Well, now that's 440 pounds per acre. Your yields 20 bushels higher. That's almost 1,000 pounds more residue on your field that you may be tilling or managing the same way you have the last 20 years. So tilling, I guess, is to answer your question, what's the most effective strategy? That's probably the best and first approach to really go after residue.
Yeah, that presents a conundrum, really. I mean, we're in an environment right now where there's a lot of emphasis on soil health, on regenerative practices. And so residue management and, you know, most effective being tillage, right? Then that is actually going at a contrast to some of these other efforts, right? Are there things that farmers can be doing that maybe start to balance this out a little bit?
100%. And that's where some of the research projects are focused, is beyond tillage. What else could we look at? And I refer to tillage as mechanical, but then we think chemical or biological approaches. Chemical meaning fertility. You hear continuous corn systems need more nitrogen because of the nitrogen tie-up. A little bit of nitrogen, and we're looking at sulfur in these high residue systems. It helps the microbes maybe go after the residue and break it down naturally a little bit. And does that allow us to minimize our tillage? And because we're feeding the microbes. And then the biological space, it's expanding quite rapidly. You know, I think the nitrogen fixing biologicals in 2019 or so really was a big push. But now when I look at new products coming, it's a big push on biological products, basically microbial mixes for residue decomposition, with the idea of it allows us to maybe get away from needing that fall tillage pass, and we can focus on these more conservation systems. So mechanical, chemical, and biological would be the three bins of practices you can choose from.
Sure. Now, do you see, I know in Iowa, we kind of see, you know, if you go from a you know, maybe a continuous corn system to a corn soybean rotation, the soybeans don't necessarily care as much about that residue. And so then therefore we can maybe go with a little bit of higher residue load going into that soybean year and then thinking about managing the residue differently, you know, again, before it comes back into corn. Do you have much that you're talking about there or working with on that end of it?
Yeah, so definitely conversations, no direct personal experience at this time, but we're starting to look more back into tillage or tillage timing by rotation systems. A lot of our work has focused on continuous corn, or we've been looking at cover crop management, managing the spring residues of the cover crops, but by and large, that corn response. The soybean is interesting, though, as we push for earlier and earlier planting, maybe that uniform stand and conditions in April, the residues maybe haven't broken down as much. So this is where things like maybe strip till or some of these different precision planter technologies with really good row cleaners or placements can help get through that as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, conundrum, right? Soybeans don't look great in a no-till, you know, corn residue until, maybe, you know, I'll say early to mid-July. That's when, you know, everything kind of covers up that past residue and you see this nice, you know, field of green soybeans. So you mentioned strip tillage. Do you have a lot of strip tillage occurring in Illinois?
It's growing. I mean, the biggest push is the equipment needs a little horsepower to pull it or it slows you down. And so time, you know, we all could use more time no matter where you're at. But I do see a lot more interest in that. And especially you look at today's P&K prices, if you can strip till with fertility placement, that in our research has just been a win-win. We really like strip till banded fertility systems. A lot of questions yet remain. Does that allow you to reduce your rates a little bit? And how do you alter year over year going back? But seeing a good push for it, and it comes back to the conversations and points you made. Tillage, best for residue management, maybe not best for big picture systems to keep the soils in place and think those soil health. So it's strip till the balance. I think that theme and drive is growing and we'll push that area moving forward.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a renewed interest in strip tillage here in even just the last 3 or 4 years. And part of it is we're putting the nutrients in the root zone, and we can maybe protect the soil a little bit as well, right? And so we're starting to see that interest come around again, especially, you know, in areas of the state that are a little bit on the flatter side. There's still challenges, you know, where we have rolling hills in southern Iowa. There's some logistical issues that come along with that. And quite honestly, those may be not the most ideal places for strip tillage either. You know, in those situations, no-till is probably still the better answer.
I would agree. And we see the same thing if it's not tillage or strip till, these mechanical sizing combine rollers. That's another way to go about residue management. Works great on the flats, but when you get into hilly ground, sometimes that means it can flow downhill and definitely what practice is best for the right acre. Always going to be a challenge you and I face and every farm faces.
Yeah. Farming is very specific to the field and to the producer, the farmer, right? And yeah, we just always have seen that. Let's switch gears here just a little bit and talk a little bit about the work you're doing with corn root system architecture and some of the things you're finding there. So how does corn root system architecture vary between hybrids? Is there a lot of differences occurring there?
Short answer is yes. There is a lot of variation in the root architecture, but it's not been traditionally looked at, largely because shovel omics, as we call it, is not an easy task and approach. But I think there's a new frontier in looking at root architecture from a hybrid placement perspective.
Is this maybe, you know, kind of tying our topics together a little bit? Is this an opportunity that, you know, we can maybe get some assistance on the residue management side, the nutrient uptake side in some of these higher residue, maybe even no-till systems?
I think so. And again, like you said, how do we tie this together? If we're, you know, tillage mixes the soil profile. So we're getting good nutrient stratification or non-stratification, mixing of the nutrients. So most root systems can find the nutrients in those tilled scenarios. When we switch to these other practices, like using extra fertility or these biologicals as an alternative for residue management, that may help us manage the residue for better seeding in the following year. But all of that's still in the surface. And what we can see sometimes in no-till or less disturbed systems, nutrient stratification into the surface layers and bringing it to the root architecture. Roots vary very widely in their architecture. We've been looking at three main factors. There's the surface area. So just how fibrous are those roots? We look at the root angle. Are they a wide angle? Sometimes people refer to those as umbrella roots, or a narrow angle that maybe grows deep. And then we just look at the pure mass. How dense are those? The PhD student I have to give a shout out here is Sam Laskonich. And if you take surface area, angle, and mass as an acronym, that's S-A-A-M or SAM. So we have our SAM rating led by student Sam Laskonich. But he's doing some interesting things in what he has found. We'll use sidedress nitrogen split N as an example. The wider angled roots are more responsive to split applied nitrogen. And that makes sense because they're in the surface area. Those umbrella roots are wide. They're in the surface profile. So that sidedress N goes right to where the roots are. We find narrow roots that drive deep do really well in stressed environments because they're either chasing the nitrogen down, or if it's water stress, they're looking for that. And so now we start piecing the story together. What type of root is best for your system? And this is where maybe in a no-till high-yield environment where we have nutrients in the surface, do we need to be selecting wide-rooted hybrids to find the nutrients in the surface soils? Whereas if we're in fuller, more tilled systems, a more general root that has a good surface area and explores the soil is the better pick. That's the type of questions that we're looking at, thinking about what about a root architecture influences where we might place it.
That's really quite interesting to kind of think about it from that mentality. As I was listening to you, I was thinking about, you know, how water use efficiency comes into play with root architecture. And you described kind of those wide angle roots as being more shallow. Does that mean that they're going to be more susceptible in maybe droughtier or drier environments? Or do we still have enough, so to speak, rooting depth that we don't necessarily see some of those challenges?
Yeah, and this is where I pull the agronomist card of it depends. One of the things that others as well are trying to figure out, when do the roots establish those phenotypes? Are they wide from the start, or do they develop that wide pattern, you know, when they start in V8, between V8 and VT? And when does that really come in? Probably on the water stress then is when does the stress occur? And we know if we're water stressed early, and if we time it right, roots will grow deep to try and find that. But if we have too much water early, they kind of stay in there. And then if we get dry, we lose that. But in theory, yes, if we get too dry and we have a wide angle, you might see a higher stress on that versus the narrow that drive deeper naturally and are already following that water line as it dries up. So I would say plausible. A wider might be more prone to drought stress.
Yeah, you bring up another question that I think is kind of important to understand. So you've mentioned obviously that there's hybrid differences. How much does management or weather dictate what that phenotype looks like?
So interestingly, what Sam has now been doing, he's planting the same hybrids in different sites in different years and ranking them relative to each other. You know, is a narrow root always a narrow root? And the key thing here is, how do you define narrow or wide or large surface area? It is relative to other genetics in the area when we think of a rating. But does it change? And surprisingly, what he has found, we've got our Southern Illinois site, which is a 1.8 to 2.0 organic matter versus our Northern sites, which are 3.5 or higher. And then we had two dry years and then a wet year. The rankings for the most part are the same. So that hybrid root architecture seems to be constrained to the genetics. Now, environment changes overall root development. We've seen our southern site much smaller roots, but the narrow ones are still the narrow ones, and the wide ones are still the wide ones. The hybrids characterize themselves the same way. So that's been really interesting. So environment will change the overall structure, size, and development, but it doesn't change a specific hybrid's natural rooting approach.
Okay. So there may be some plasticity, but it's not, it's much more hybrid related than it is environment.
Yes.
Okay. This is all really fascinating to kind of think about, you know, how you know, we generally are selecting hybrids based on the basically the yield potential of it, right? And I don't blame people for that, right? That's the number one factor that we need to be considering. And then we tend to throw in, you know, traits or disease, you know, resistance, tolerance, those types of things. But now what I'm really hearing you say is we need the seed companies to be putting root architecture on their rating scales so that way we can start selecting, you know, for the right environment, essentially.
Well, and you bring up a great point. We select for the highest yield potential, but most of those selections are managed the same way. The, you know, 30-inch row, adequate nitrogen, you know, we call it the beauty contest. Every different hybrids may maximize their yield in a depending on the system you throw them into. And again, we can loop the two conversations we've had on residue to hybrids back together with the strip till. You know, if you're trying to balance residue management without just requiring full tillage and you're going strip till, we did a couple years ago two studies side by side. They were almost identical studies looking at phosphorus placement by source and looking at the broadcast or the banding, there's just a slight tweak between the trials. So they were separated side by side. The placement effect on trial A was phenomenal, like a 10 bushel advantage to banded versus broadcast. The trial right next to it was a wash. And we're just like, how can you have that big of a response difference? They were planted the same day, same P rates, same P sources. There's just a few later season stuff we changed. And we looked at the hybrid. That was the key difference between those two studies. We had a large rooted surface area hybrid in the trial that was non-responsive because those roots explore the soil. They find the nutrients in the band, but also in the broadcast and what's in the soil. In the really responsive trial, the small rooted hybrid was the key, because if you're a small root, you find the band, you're right at the buffet line. But if you don't have the band and you broadcast it, that small root doesn't find it. So huge difference there. And back to where we kind of went. Yes, I think if you pick the right hybrid for your system, that can make you get a few more bushels out of what you're already doing.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Yeah, this has been a really, really fascinating conversation. And I know, you know, if I had another 20 minutes, we would have jumped into, you know, the biologicals, the biostimulants. We'd even talk about a mutual interest that we have with phantom yield loss. But I think we're going to have to hold on to those, you know, for maybe another episode down the road here. Connor, it's time now for our final three questions. So the first question that I have for you is, what is your go-to agronomic resource?
That's a good one. There's a couple different approaches to it, but these days I really like podcasts or blogs, and a lot of those blogs are from different extension programs. Iowa State has some good blogs you guys put out, Minnesota, Purdue, like those are the blogs, and then the podcast, different platforms are out there. But why I like listening to agronomists that are in podcasts or blogs is it's more conversational. It's more off the cuff what you're seeing, and I think reflective of the scenarios that we run into. So those are my go-to these days is podcasts and blogs because of just the style and the way that the information comes out. I think it's easier to process and then think about applying that to the situations we may run into.
So, you're recently through your degrees and postdoc and fresh into your role as a research assistant professor. So this is maybe not a fair question because I don't think you have a lot of time establishing yourself. But what do you like to do in your free time?
Well, it's always busy, but got to have hobbies for sure. So I do have two Australian Shepherds. And the way I like to phrase that is I don't take my dogs for a walk. My dogs take me for a walk. So do a lot of time with the dogs. And then I don't live too far from the forest preserve that's got a nice fishing hole. So get the fishing poles out when we can as well.
Very good. Very good. Sounds like a nice, relaxing thing to do on a, you know, busy summer day, right? Mm-hmm. And then lastly here, where can our listeners go to learn more about the research that you're doing?
So we have a website. Back to your comment about free time. We manage the website in our free time, so might look a little dated. But cropphysiology.cropsci.illinois.edu. Sometimes just Google search crop physiology. We're usually the one or two top links. I have an extension resources tab on there where we've got podcast recordings, webinars, slide decks. So that's probably the best place to find out more about our program, what we're running with. And then you can find me on Twitter, you know, posting on there still, or X these days, I guess.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go to your webpage and tag that in my favorites to be able to go to again. So, well, that concludes another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Connor, thank you for joining us today. If you have enjoyed today's episode, please let us know and leave us a review. Your feedback is invaluable to us. It helps us identify, you know, our next guests, or maybe even go back to previous guests if you have questions for them. So until next time, this is Mark Licht with the Crop Science Podcast Show.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.